Last Word on Today FM.
And so for the Culture Club today, we're delighted to be joined by one of the country's top chefs, Gary O'Hanlon, who, of course, is also very well known from his television work and is the co-host of the food podcast Dishing It Out, which has just been renewed for a fifth season. How do you do food and cooking on a podcast? I mean, we all see what you do on television, but when you go to a podcast, what are you doing?
Yeah, so I suppose a lot of it really is delving into everybody's memories of food and life through food, you know what I mean? And cooking's interesting in the sense that everybody throws their hand at it at some stage, Matt, and everybody has their opinions on it or thoughts on it. And, you know, we initially sort of thought it was going to just be a show packed with chefs or whatever, and we just realised only last week, coming back from All Together Now, that we're, God, like, we haven't had a chef on in a while. We need to maybe get a few more. So it's people really that are in the media, that are a bit well known, and then we always ultimately, it's about them, but then it'll always come back to food and some shape or form, and everybody's got some great memories of food through the years or are dabbing into it. But yeah, it's doing really well, thank God, which is why we're back for a fifth season and we're a few episodes into it now and it's going great.
And tell us about the new job. Well, it's not quite new now, but you're only in your second year down in the K Club.
That's right.
Very elite address down in County Kildare.
Yeah, it is, yeah. I mean, myself and Mark Moriarty have been golfing there over the last amount of years. Like, The K Club, like a small handful of places in Ireland, they're just such iconic venues, like hotels and that, you know what I mean? But obviously, with the Ryder Cup, having been there, you know. But for me, it's about way more than that. Like, it's just, you know, it's five star, first and foremost. I've just had a love affair with the place for like a long, long time, you know. Nothing to do with my bad golf game, but I've just always had a soft spot for it, you know what I mean? And back whenever Michael Fellerstone would have bought it in 2019, you know, I actually had a few opportunities to go, but I just started in a chateau in France at that stage. But look, I was coming back to Ireland a couple of years ago. The opportunity came up again and, you know, it meant me not having to travel into Dublin for work either. Like, I live in the Midlands, I live in Longford, you know, it's still an hour away, but it's just the ideal job, high standard, and so far so good.
But what exactly would you have to oversee as the chef down there? Because obviously breakfast for hotel residents, lunches, dinners, but there's weddings and you would have maybe high-end dining for guests. You'd also have the golf clubhouses. There's two of those, isn't there?
Yeah, two restaurants, the Palmer Restaurant, then South Restaurant. We've got the fine dining restaurant in the hotel, which is the Barton. You also have the Henry Lounge within the hotel building. And then we would have our suite, the Legacy Suite, like for conference and banqueting, weddings, the APR, the Arnold Palmer Room, which is for weddings up to about 150.
So how many chefs are you overseeing?
There's about 42 something, yeah, mid-40s, yeah, over 40 chefs. It's an incredibly busy F&B operation. Everything from food and wine events and tasting dinners, degustation dinners, to just the general, you know, you've got the high-end bistro like the Palmer. The South End is a bit more, you know, family, local vibe, really funky, cool cocktails, that sort of stuff. And then you have the white tablecloth, fine dining in the main hotel. And, you know, it's steeped in France as well and that connection to the Barton family. Like, so, you know, you would have sole tableside, like sole off the bone, on the bone at the tableside, which is really classical French cookery and techniques. And, you know, that's something that's really important, that you keep that sort of vibe and feel and just that general feeling of just excellence, like whenever you're in the meal. So there's a dining room for every kind of a mood that you're in, which is brilliant in a resort. You know, you kind of can be there for a week and go to all these different types of venues, and it's magic. Yeah, but it's a body of work to,
well, yeah,
keep
it's executive
running.
Head chef, how much time do you actually spend cooking yourself in the kitchen?
Funny enough, like a good bit, you know. I mean, I do every wedding. I'm involved in every single wedding. Whenever I write a menu, look, whenever I write a menu for one restaurant and then I'll go into training for like a week or two, you'll guide. Each restaurant has their own head chef, sous chef. They almost run independent. They have that support network of me and the other teams, but they ultimately run as their own restaurant, really. So then I tend to write all the menus with the chefs. I love involvement from the head chefs and their team. I'll always go in then around that time, get everything perfect, develop a standard, and then step out. But once you step out, you're working on the next menu for the next restaurant. And when you take three restaurants, four seasons, and you're changing every season, you're tweaking within a season, and then all the food and wine events, whether it's a tasting dinner paired with whiskey, if it's food and wine or whatever it may be, we tend to do four or five of them a year as well at different times. And so yeah, like I find myself cooking. I'm in kitchens every single day, I can tell you that. I rarely sit in my office, generally a Saturday evening between 2 and 5, and then maybe an hour or two most evenings. But outside of that, I'm in kitchens all the time.
You mentioned your golfing buddy, Mark Moriarty, who's done the Culture Club previously. And Nevin Maguire was also in doing a Culture Club because he really has enormous love of music.
That's
and
right.
Loves his decks, which he has up in McNeans. We'll get to all of your choices now. So, yeah. And we'll start with the music. And tell us the first single that you can remember purchasing or having given to you.
Yeah, it was a toss-up for me, this one, you know. It was The Final Countdown. It was either Eye of the Tiger or The Final Countdown. And I don't know if I've mixed them up or whatever, but I vividly remember having like a wee, I don't even know, because I never had a record player all that long. I'm probably showing my age now anyways. I love the Culture Club, as you probably know, but I do love listening to everybody going back and the weird and wacky. But anything that was kind of motivational, even from a really young age, I loved. You know, I mean, I'm sport mad. I, you know, from a management point of view as well, I love to kind of manage by motivating, and you know, that sort of player manager thing. You always hear Harry Redknapp or Kevin Keegan, and when I played ball, there was a guy Joey Regan. You always just adapted well to people that were motivators, you know. But music,
I thought you were a Manchester United obsessive. you're not going to mirror or sort of do Alex Ferguson on management of your staff, are you?
No,
the hair dryer out and shouting at them.
Yeah, Fergie was a different breed. Yeah, a bit more old school. Yeah, but no, I love that personal touch that you would have definitely felt off the likes of, you know, when you hear all these stories over the years, you know, of Keegan or Redknapp. But going back to music, like, yeah, The Final Countdown, that day, my uncle Bug, that's his Martin, but his nickname was Bug, like, he was music mad. It would have been loads of Whitesnake and all that sort of stuff that he would have been playing back in the day. But I just vividly remember getting my hands on The Final Countdown and playing it, and that along with Eye of the Tiger. It could have been a toss-up. So
okay,
yeah.
Well, it's not Eye of the Tiger by Survivor that we have. It's The Final Countdown by Europe. '86, I just checked, was when that came out. You were in Nipper then, were you?
I was, yeah. What would I have been? Eight? Yeah, eight or nine, yeah, at that stage. Yeah.
Okay, favourite album? And you said this is an easy one, and it also is your favourite band or artist who produced this album.
Yeah, Performance and Cocktails, Stereophonics. I absolutely love the Phonics, as we always call them, you know. I would have taken my younger brother, Kevin. I lived in Boston for many years, and I flew him over a few times to watch the Phonics over in Boston. We've been to watch them in England, obviously in Ireland and a few different places.
Why? What's the attraction of Stereophonics?
I don't know. I just from the very first time I heard them, I loved them. Kelly Jones, the lead singer, his voice, just that gravelly voice, like he was just amazing. I don't know, that like performance in Cocktails as far as an album, like one track after another. I used to think, you know, you would get an album back in the day, there was always two or three decent songs, but Performance in Cocktails was one of those ones that just felt like every song, like the next one was better than the last one. Loved it. I've been fortunate, as I said, to see them and many big stadiums, but equally Ricochet out at RT at one stage. I remember we were going to watch them in Dublin, but he was having like a little audience of 10 out at RT. So I ended up bartering something with him to sneak in there, and we got to see them the day of the concert in the radio studio over there, just like a handful of us. Magic, you know, and yeah, just a brilliant singer.
Okay, it's 1999 that album comes from. It was the second album from the Stereophonics. And the track we have is Pick Apart That's New. Stereophonics from Performance and Cocktails, the album choice from Gary O'Hanlon, who is our Culture Club guest today. You got to see them live, but they're not down as the best gig you were at.
No, they're not. No, I mean, look, they've been at some, you just mentioned 99 here. I think they actually warmed up for Robbie Williams at Slane in 99 as well. I'm nearly positive. And then I was living there, they headlined it, but I wasn't in Ireland. But I would say it's a toss-up between the Saw Doctors, which was a big shock to me at the Paradise Club, or Moby. I watched Moby at a live gig. It was an outdoor venue outside of Boston somewhere. So one or the other. I had Mammy and my Aunt Carmel were coming over to visit one year. And I was like, God, like, what am I going to do with them? Like, I bought a few tickets to go here and there. We popped down to New York for a couple of days. And then the Saw Doctors happened to be playing in the Paradise Club, which is a famous rock club in Boston. And so I says, look, not my cup of tea, but we'll go. They absolutely blew my mind live. It was one of the most incredible gigs I can ever remember. And I would have played football for the Irish Village over there. I was in the Mass State Soccer League, and Diageo or Guinness North America would have sponsored us. And every year at the Roxy, 40 of us used to go to the Roxy on Paddy's Day, or the day before or day after Paddy's Day. The Saw Doctors always played at the Roxy Club. So we had tickets, and then we started going. I told all the boys in the team about the night at the Paradise Club. Sure, for years then we went to watch them nearly every year, you know what I mean? Absolutely. And they, consequently, over the years, I've heard them in interviews saying that every gig they do, like, they play it like it's their last gig. And I firmly believe what they're saying there, because I just could not get over how brilliant they were, you know, real high tempo magic.
And at those gigs in Boston, would it have been all full of Irish people living in the United States, or would there have been Americans there as well who would have gotten it?
Oh yeah, there would have been Americans, that would have had fans all over, you know what I mean? But more than likely, you have such a connection with Ireland and America over there. I mean, you'd imagine it would have been the first wave of Irish going over, there would have been fans of theirs, and then their kids are growing up, fans or whatnot. But I know, just from the crowd and the Roxy, I mean, I lived in Boston that long. Like, you'd be bumped every second person you bumped into. You know, I was over four or five different restaurants over there, so you got to know an awful lot of people. But I would say they've got a big audience from America as well as just Ireland. You know what I mean? Like, it was never, but look, primarily it's probably the Irish flying over to watch them. They've got some fanatical fans, I know that for sure.
How long were you in Boston for?
About 6 years. I mean, I've got such a love for Boston or an affinity to the place, I almost feel like it was 20 years, but it was around 6 years. And it was right in the early part, not right after, pretty much right after college and right up to my mid late 20s. I lived there and yeah, made a big mark. I mean, I loved the place, you know.
Tell us about the Moby gig you saw there.
Yeah, so this was Outkast were playing, Oasis were playing, and then there was somebody else as well. I wish you could think on the name of the venues, but an hour and a half outside the city. We used to go every now and again. It was this sort of theatre that the embankment was grass. I'm sure somebody at some stage will remember the name of it. But anyways, Moby was basically the headliner. That was the last gig of the night. Like, there was different stages hosting different stuff. So I says, look, we'll roll over, I'll sit up in the grass bank, have a few drinks and just wind down or whatever. Then he just came on and the whole place was just electric. I mean, I would have liked a couple of...
You were
of
up on your feet.
Yeah, I was up from start to finish. Once he started, it was just... I could not believe someone that I just wasn't a big fan of had such... It probably had more hits as well than I would have even realised. I'm sure that's happened to yourself over the years. Yeah. You're at a gig, you're like, God, like, I didn't know this was yours. But from start to finish, that Moby gig just blew me away. Like, an unbelievable performer. You know, he was amazing.
We don't actually have anything from that Boston gig, but we do have Moby live with Why Does My Heart Feel So Bad? Why does my heart... some reason I always associate that track with the Bourne movies. I could be wrong. I don't know if it even is there, but anyway. And let's go on to movies, actor and director, because you're a big Tom Cruise fan.
Yeah, love him. He's just brilliant. You know, I suppose just from every movie he's in, like, I don't know if it's the effort he puts in and obviously he's famous for being really particular. You know, lots of stuff came out over the last years, especially during the whole Mission Impossible franchise, about his work ethic and all sorts. But just everything he's been in, like Days of Thunder, the likes of that, just top drawer, Risky Business, going way, way back.
God, you are going back to the very early movies.
Yeah, that was early doors, yeah. Brilliant as well. Jerry Maguire, he was magic in. Yeah, but then I suppose Born on the 4th of July, he's never done... I think he got a nomination.
That's the Vietnam movie where he played the guy in the wheelchair, his name escapes me.
Yeah.
Real life figure, yeah.
Even the whole movie escapes me a bit, like, but it's a long, long time ago. That would have been the early 2000s when that came out.
Way beyond, earlier than that. Late 1980s, early 1990s.
Oh, wow.
It's an Oliver Stone movie.
Yeah, I didn't think it was that far back.
It is.
I think he got a nomination for that, which is a shame he didn't win an Oscar, because it's a career that feels like it should have got more. I think Cuba Gooding Jr. got an Oscar, I think, for Jerry Maguire.
That's right.
Yeah, for the supporting role. But yeah, just everything he's ever been in, like, just absolutely magic. There's something really good about everything.
Let's just hear a bit of... A lot of people say it was his finest role ever before you got your Mission Impossibles and things like that. This is Born on the 4th of July.
What's going on? Are you drunk again?
Hey, Mom.
He's drunk again. Eli, we have a drunk for a son. Leave that. You leave that alone. Leave. Give that to. You can't stay in this house.
This is what you believe in, isn't it, Mom? This is what you believe in, but I don't.
You can't stay in this house.
I don't believe in him anymore.
Go to bed, honey.
Because he only had to spend 3 days up there. Me, I got to spend the rest of my life. I wish I were dead like him.
You don't know what you're saying.
That's the problem, Mom. I'm not dead. I got to live. I got to live and I got to roll around. I got to remind him of Vietnam. And you don't want to know. You don't want to see us. You want to hide us. You want to hide us because it is a can of shit. And I am a fucking dummy.
He won't listen. He won't change.
Ronnie, please. You got to take your mom seriously. You can't drink in this house.
Everything they told us.
Go fight. Go kill. Sergeant, ma'am, rain, car. Yes, car left. Car left. Car left. You know, it's all a lie. The whole thing is just a bunch of money.
Why? Stop it. Go to bed. You sleep it off. What did they do to you in that war? What happened to you? You need help, Ronnie. You need help.
You need help. With all your God and your bullshit dreams about
me. Wake up the whole thing.
You are ashamed of me.
Okay, Tom Cruise in what may be his finest role. Ron Kovich is the character that he played, who became a prominent anti-war activist coming back paralyzed from the Vietnam War.
Wow.
It's a great movie.
So it's based on a true story, obviously. Yeah. Yeah, I never knew all of that. Well, obviously, like the war, but yeah, it was just, even there, hearing that, it's a lifetime since I've watched it, you know what I mean? I was like, going, God, I got to go back to that.
That's
one.
Exactly what I was saying. Another great one of his is Magnolia.
Oh, yeah.
With all the music from Amy Mann and Supertramp and the rest of it. We'll get to the rest of your movie choices and your TV and books and other things, including a great choice that you have for your buried treasure. Gary O'Hanlon, staying with us for The Culture Club, more after this. Welcome back to The Culture Club, where Gary O'Hanlon is with us, co-host of the food podcast Dishing It Out. Now, more movies. You want to talk, Clint Eastwood, Ben Affleck as directors.
Yeah, and I'd have to try and think now about all the shows they've done, but I mean, everything that Ben Affleck in particular has ever directed, like, I suppose it would have started with Good Will Hunting, am I right?
Yeah.
Was he involved in, I know he part wrote it as well or whatever, but...
With Matt Damon, yeah.
Yeah, with Matt Damon. Just, I mean, talk about starting your career on a high. He's just, he gets an Oscar off the bat, you know.
And for the Clint Eastwood ones, is it the cowboy movies, the westerns, is it the sort of more modern stuff that he's done?
The more recent stuff, yeah. Like, I think he directed Mule, didn't he?
Yeah.
Like, he was part of that. Gran Torino would have been one of his as well.
Yeah.
And then, is it Gone? The Town, Ben Affleck, did he direct The Town? That was another one that has the Boston roots. And Gone Girl. Gone Girl? Is that the right name on it?
Yeah.
They were unbelievable. Clint Eastwood's probably done even more. Like, but all of his modern stuff, the one with the fighter, the boxer, the name is leaving me now. Did she get paralyzed or trying to think of it? Is that ringing a bell with you?
It sort of is, but I can't. It's on the tip of my tongue and I can't remember. Yeah. But listen, there's another movie, because we'll just move it on, that you want to mention, which will bring us into what you like in books as well. Moneyball with Brad Pitt.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Moneyball just blew me away. It was an incredible... I keep going back to Boston, right? But there's actually
it finishes in Boston.
It finishes in Boston, of course, obviously, when John Henry was making Billy Beane the offer to become the highest paid sports manager.
But it starts in Oakland.
But it starts in Oakland, yeah. It's about the Oakland A's that basically, on probably the lowest budget of all time in MLB, they made it to a World Series, didn't win it, but they did break a winning record that had been around. They went into they broke 20-21 games or whatever it was. They had a streak, and where money really matters in American sports, like, you know, you're looking at the millions that the Yankees Steinbrenner would have been the owner of the Yankees at the time that this movie was made about the Oakland A's. You're looking at a fraction of the budget, but the team outplayed them, and they just ended up making a story about Billy Beane, really, who was the general manager, and he sort of played a character.
But he followed mathematical formulas, and he identified players not on the basis of looking at a scouting by the naked eye, but looking completely at stats.
Economics, yeah. They literally brought numbers, the numbers game into pro sports. So it wasn't about how many home runs you had, it was how many times you got on base. He hired an economist to put together the team. That's how they did it. And ever since that, every other major team now and pro soccer to you name it, Brighton is one of the, Liverpool's another one apparently that has been early adopters. Brentford have been very good at it in recent times. And Billy Beane, who was the GM, he turned down Boston, actually. He turned down the Red Sox, and then they eventually hired a young guy called Theo Epstein, who, I lived there at the time, and Theo Epstein was a really young GM in a sports franchise thing that just doesn't have managers in their 30s. They're usually 50s, 60s and beyond. But he came in and using the formulas and the whole idea behind the Oakland A's and what Moneyball was written about, and they broke the curse of the Bambino. After 86 years, Boston in 2004 won their first World Series in over 80 years. And that's who they hired on the back of Billy Beane turning them down. But they still followed, like, the whole, you know, they followed the numbers as opposed to the stars.
Moneyball, the movie, of course, was based on the Michael Lewis book. And Michael Lewis has been a guest on many occasions on this programme. So I believe you love Moneyball in particular, but also The Fifth Risk as another of his books.
Oh, the book. Yeah, Michael Lewis. I've heard you interview him actually over the years. Just an incredible guy. And The Fifth Risk, I'd read it like maybe 5 or 6 months before. I was going to Gonzaga. I was doing something out there. I always remember where I was. It was pouring rain. I was like, oh my God, that's Michael Lewis. And I was listening to you on with him. But yeah, it was all about Trump's first presidency. And I don't even know how I came on it or where I heard, but obviously it intrigued me some way or other. But The Fifth Risk is basically all about how governments are ran, and it was a lot of it was about what didn't show up whenever Trump took office or won the election. And obviously from the election until the inauguration, there's that period,
the transition,
the transition period. And basically from the Department of Energy to the Department of Agriculture and so on.
Weather control, all that sort of thing.
Yes, everybody was waiting for the staff to show up. Day one, nobody. Day two, nobody. And day three, nobody, and so on. But it's whenever you start reading about it and you hear what government actually does and what Trump just turned his back on. Frightening.
Let's have a clip from the audio edition of The Fifth Risk by Michael Lewis.
Chris Christie noticed a piece in the New York Times. That's how it all started. The New Jersey governor had dropped out of the presidential race in February 2016 and thrown what support he had behind Donald Trump. In late April, he saw the article. It described meetings between representatives of the remaining candidates still in the race: Trump, John Kasich, Ted Cruz, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders, and the Obama White House. Anyone who still had any kind of shot at becoming president of the United States apparently needed to start preparing to run the federal government. The guy Trump sent to the meeting was, in Christie's estimation, comically underqualified. Christie called up Trump's campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, to ask why this critical job hadn't been handed to someone who actually knew something about government. "We don't have anyone," said Lewandowski. Christie volunteered himself for the job, head of the Donald Trump presidential transition team. "It's the next best thing to being president," he told friends. "You get to plan the presidency." He went to see Trump about it. Trump said he didn't want a presidential transition team. Why did anyone need to plan anything before he actually became president? "It's legally required," said Christie. Trump asked where the money was going to come from to pay for the transition team. Christie explained that Trump could either pay for it himself or take it out of campaign funds. Trump didn't want to pay for it himself. He didn't want to take it out of campaign funds either. But he agreed, grudgingly, that Christie should go ahead and raise a separate fund to pay for his transition team. "But not too much," he said. And so Christie set out to prepare for the unlikely event that Donald Trump would one day be elected president of the United States.
There's also, I'd say, a great book to be done on the transition for the second presidency, because it was done entirely in a different way. They were ready this time to go in and wreak the havoc that they actually did.
You know, I was only thinking that, actually. I was like, I wonder, has he made the same mistakes this time around?
No, it was done very differently this time around. You also are a big fan of Ben Mezrich and his books.
He's amazing, yeah. The first time I came across him was when I read Bringing Down the House. And that was the book about the mathematical geniuses that were all put together at MIT, another Boston, great Boston institution. And they basically took Vegas for millions as card counters and strategy. And obviously, you know, it's not illegal. It's just frowned upon. And I remember, you know, I used to go over with a bunch of buddies around March every year for March Madness. You know, used to fly into Boston or New York, a couple of nights partying, and then jump on a plane over to Vegas for a long weekend. And I remember saying one time, geez, you know, like, you should write a book about this place and all that happens. And next thing, around that time, Bringing Down the House came out. And the following year, I was actually in Vegas when they had the premiere of 21. So they made the movie 21. If anybody's ever seen 21, it's based on the Ben Mezrich book, Bringing Down the House. It is an unbelievable read. It's just his books, once you start them, like, you're just hooked into them. And that's something that he's, you know, it's quite intentional. Just a brilliant writer, another guy from Boston. And that's just coincidental, I think, or at least I hope. But he's done a few. He's a new one, I think, coming out. It might be out by now, Bitcoin Billionaires. I think that's about the Winklevoss twins
involved in Facebook originally and had the legal falling out with
Zuckerberg.
Yeah,
so they're early adopters and early fans of Bitcoin, and he's done a book on them. I have a feeling it might not be out yet, but it's called Bitcoin Billionaires. There's a few others, like there's one on oil as well. I've read a few of them. Some of the names have left me now. There's one about the moon, about moon rock and the price of it. He's just magic.
Okay. Favourite play, theatre show, musical? You've gone for Riverdance.
Yeah, I loved it. Now, this might be because I brought wee Cora, my daughter, my only daughter. I have two sons and a daughter. And I took wee Cora and her best buddy, Nicole, and bought the VIP package. So, you know, met the dancers and all of that. And there was the 30-year anniversary there a couple of years ago, and we brought them. It's just one of the best nights that the two of us have had together. And she loved it. We just got completely immersed in it. And I just think they're amazing. I've actually done the wedding. It wasn't Jean Butler. I think it might have been the girl that replaced her or was involved at one stage. All I know is I cooked a wedding for one of the senior dancers back in the day in Donegal, and I didn't get to meet them too long. I was just chatting for a while. But Riverdance Live, unreal. It's amazing.
Television. As a kid, you went for what? The A-Team. You have the tribute haircut for B.A. Baracus.
I do. Yeah. It probably suits him a bit better, but there you go.
That suits you very well, Gary.
Yeah, it's A-Team Dukes of Hazzard. I absolutely, I love rallying, I love action, wrecking stuff. This will be no surprise to Mammy if she's listening anyways. Airwolf is another one. Do you remember Airwolf?
No.
Oh, wow. Airwolf was about a chopper pilot. It was like a, I don't know what sort of a helicopter. I thought it was the coolest thing going. I'd say if I was to watch an episode of Airwolf now, it's probably some slow play or whatever I'd be expecting to see, like this Apache, and it's probably something shocking. But the A-Team, I just lived for the A-Team on a Saturday. You'd see it on. Dukes of Hazzard was the same. And like back then, you know, we didn't have TV the way we did now. Like you had to, it was on at a certain time. And if you weren't in front of the TV, you were missing it. But then Santa every year as well. I had all the Dukes of Hazzard stunt gear, all the setup, the studio stuff. Loved it. And then obviously the cars over the years, the General Lees, like they're just gorgeous.
Did the Keith Floyd chefing TV shows get you into your profession?
It wouldn't have got me into it. No, I've just had a love affair with cooking from when I was very, very young. But Floyd, there was only two chefs really on TV, serious chefs on TV in the early part of my life. It was Keith Floyd and Gary Rhodes. So Gary Rhodes definitely influenced some seriously bad hairdos over the years. I loved, Gary Rhodes was a really underappreciated chef, but a lot of really good cooks in the UK in particular would know when he was at himself in the early days of his career, like he was a serious operator. Keith Floyd was just amazing. He was just so fluid on TV. He had such a love with food. There's probably the only other one, and he would have discovered him, as Rick Steen. The same producer, David something or other, he died there a year or two ago, discovered Keith Floyd, and that both of them discovered Rick Steen after filming down in Cornwall. But both of their just natural ways on TV, they're so easy to listen to. They're really simplistic way of cooking, which there's a word I'm not a big fan of when it comes to cooking, is simplistic. Simple is only simple when you really are a master of your craft, and like being able to put two or three things together, emulsifying butter sauces and stuff like that, and especially cooking seafood. I could have watched Floyd all day long. He was just the master. Brilliant.
And great, and knocking back the red wine with it as well.
Yeah, did like
I see in your adult life, you love a TV police procedural. I love a couple of your choices, Line of Duty and Bosch. Yeah. I'm not sure enough people know about Bosch, which is based on the Michael Connelly books.
Yeah, Bosch is amazing. Trying to think of the actor's name now, but it'll come.
I can see him and it's gone out of my head.
And there's another one now, Ballard, actually. Bosch pops up in that every now and again if you've come across it. If you like Bosch, you might like Ballard. She appeared in one or two episodes near the end of the last season of Bosch or Bosch Legacy, and there's a wee bit of a spin-off there. Line of Duty was another banger. I was over at a United game with a good friend of mine, the actor Lawrence Kinlan, recently, and what do you call him, out of Adrian Dunbar out of Line of Duty, joined us for a feed of pints. We had a great night out with him before the game. Just a magic actor and such a good show.
Okay, it's Titus Welliver who is the actor who plays
Bosch. Titus Welliver, yes.
To finish, we definitely applaud your choice of buried treasure because you've gone for something that somebody who is so well known as a contributor to this programme, but you've gone for one of his podcasts, Frank Greeny. Tell us a little bit about this choice.
Frank Greeny, Inside the Crime. I knew you'd like this because obviously he's filled in for you many's a time.
And he will be doing in the course of this month as well, yes.
Oh yeah, we holiday planned, good man.
Yes, at last.
Yeah, so Frank Greeny's Inside the Crime. I actually have still got one of them to listen to, which is the first one. I came across it maybe 6 months ago or thereabouts, and he zones in on, it's like a cold case basically, or a different case in Ireland, and the most recent one was about a girl that went missing. Again, her name will come to me. God, my short term memory is shocking. But Frank Greeny, who
was this, the Whelan family story?
No,
maybe a different one, because we were going to play a clip from. That is it, but we don't have time to play the clip. This is about Sharon Whelan's murder and that of her two young daughters, Zara and Nadia, Christmas Day 2008,
in
Windgap in County Kilkenny.
Yeah, it's amazing. So he goes back and he meets a fan, but like the level of detail that's in the series, like, so they're generally around 4 or 5 episodes and guts of an hour long each one. Really worth getting into. As you know from his court report in here, he's so methodical, so detailed. It's just a joy to listen to.
Also very sensitive to survivors and very respectful of the trauma that they've gone through.
And it really, really comes out in him. And you know what I love about Frank Greeny is especially, he has this little thing at the beginning of some of them where it's almost like a cutaway where he's sitting at the kitchen. You can almost hear him. You can nearly see him sitting at the table, whoever that he's meeting, and that initial sort of interaction. It's not part of the show, but you can hear that soundbite and you can just feel and hear like the empathy that he has for the people that he's interviewing and talking to or about to sit down and interview. He's just a class act and I love him.
That's a great way to finish. The Buried Treasure, Frank Greeny's Inside the Crime podcast. Your own podcast is dishing it out. Gary O'Hanlon, it's been great having you in the programme, and we managed to restrict the Manchester United mentions as well, which is good going. The Last Word on Today FM.